call this consolidated into three arguments for oral submission. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Marita Newell and others versus Thomas Arrington from El Paso County. Enron Corporation and others versus Spring Independent School District from Harris County. And Consolidated Airlines Incorporated versus Norma and Robert Keeper from Harris County, consolidated for oral argument with American Airlines Incorporated and Metro Airlines Incorporated versus Douglas O. Shoup and others from Tarrant County. The court will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each oral argument, but will complete these arguments before the noon break. Each argument has been allotted a portion of time. I'm sure counsel is familiar with what those times are. If you are the petitioner, you may reserve a portion of your argument time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded for our convenience, and if you desire to listen to a tape of the argument, you may make application and pay a small fee to the clerk of our court. We are now ready to hear argument from petitioners in Yule versus Arrington.
May it please the court, Mr. Keith Myers and Mr. Monty Kimball will present arguments to petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Myers will open with the first 13 minutes, and Mr. Myers will also present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, Mr. Stewart, Mr. Miner. On behalf of the petitioners, I shall address the issues of causation, group liability, and unincorporated associations, and one of my co-counsel, Mr. Kimball, will discuss his point on the fireman's rule. I believe it's helpful in exploring what we have in this case to first identify what we do not have. We do not have a situation of direct individual liability. The petitioners in this case were 9 of over 200 persons who were present at a demonstration. The plaintiff, a police officer, had no contact with any of these petitioners at the demonstration. He did not approach them, he did not speak to them, he did not arrest them, he did not ask them to leave, he did not touch them, he did not try to lift them. The plaintiff, the respondent herein, hurt his back while attempting to lift another individual, Sylvia Salazar, who is a party to the original lawsuit, but not to the summary judgment that was granted petitioners for this proceeding today.
Ms. Myers, it's your position that Mr. Arrington is not alleging that any of these other individuals either facilitated or encouraged or trained Ms. Salazar? You're saying he has no allegations of any negligence on the part of any of the other individuals?
Yes, Your Honor. There's no control relationship here at all between these petitioners.
That's not my question. He hasn't alleged any of that.
That's correct.
Okay.
There is another individual who is a part of a lawsuit, but also is not a part of this proceeding, who was alleged to have been the organizer and trainer herein, but not any of these individuals who simply were there, as was Ms. Salazar. Mr. Arrington admitted in the deposition in this case that he was forced to lift Ms. Salazar because she made the choice, the independent choice of her own volition, to go limp when he approached her and to cause him to lift her in order to remove her from the premises. There was no action by any of the petitioners, and none of them had anything to do with Ms. Salazar's making that independent choice or with causing Mr. Arrington to attempt to lift her. Whether or not these 9 people were there or not, whether or not they stayed or not, had nothing to do with the actual incident, the actual scenario that brought about the plaintiff's injury.
So if they all agreed going in, that's what they do, the result would be different?
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe if there had been a situation where they were actively committed to doing the same sort of conduct, they were all actively participating in the same tortious conduct, then I believe we would have a different situation.
Why isn't there a fact issue out there?
Excuse me?
Why isn't there a fact issue about that?
Well, number one, we have the plaintiff himself admitting that it was of her own choice. We have the uncontroverted testimony from all the petitioners that each person was there of his own choice. Some people left when they were asked to do so. Some people, including one of the petitioners in this case, when approached by the police, walked over to the police car. And some people did as Ms. Salazar did and went limp.
They did talk about it ahead of time.
There was a meeting in which the different alternatives were discussed, yes, sir.
Would this make, do you think the result would be different if this were a suit sounding intentional toward as opposed to negligent?
I think it would, somewhat. I think the key here is not so much whether it's intentional toward or negligence, but whether these petitioners either actively participated in the actual tortious conduct that caused the injury or somehow controlled the actions of the person who caused injury to Mr. Arrington or had the power and ability to ratify the conduct of Ms. Salazar. And we don't have any of those situations here. We certainly don't have a case of vicarious liability. As this court taught us in the Shoemaker case, vicarious liability in a group setting comes from the joint enterprise theory, which, as we know, is not intended for non-commercial context. We have no business or commercial purpose to this gathering. There was no common community of pecuniary interest, and the participants did not have an equal voice or an equal right of control as to what each of the others did out there.
But again, you don't think that matters if there had been an agreement ahead of time to go link?
I think if there has been some manifestation of control among the others, I think that would be different. Yes, sir, I do.
Well, if they're all equals, if they just all get together and say, nobody controls anybody, but this is what we're going to do, then you think there might be joint liability?
I don't know if there would be joint liability without the active participation or the actual control. I think even an agreement, while it gets a little close to the line, still doesn't go over the line if you're not actually controlling what each of the others does. For instance, in the Florida case that's cited by the Court of Appeal, the Guyton case, where they had this initiation right, the persons who were there were actually controlling and seeing to it this initiation process that injured the plaintiff. Here we have a situation where people may have talked about it, may have had some understanding among each other about it, but each still had the right to make an individual choice, and none of the other persons there was compelling or forcing him or her to participate by going limp. So I think the agreement may make it a harder question, but still without some control or active participation in the actual tortious conduct, we don't have a situation where there's a joint several liability.
So when I asked you earlier if the result would be different if there had been agreement, I thought your answer was yes. Now your answer is maybe no.
Well, I think, yes, sir, I'm rethinking it a little bit here. I think the agreement itself still would not be enough. We also don't have a situation here as in an alternative liability case where the plaintiff cannot identify the person or the instrumentality that caused his injury. There's no policy reason here for spreading the risk among the defendants in this case, and the plaintiff still has his remedy. He still has his lawsuit against Ms. Salazar and against the person who organized the activity.
So the rule might be different if the officer experienced back pain, say, the next day and could not identify the individual who he was lifting when he got hurt?
I don't know if the rule would be different, Justice Foreman. It would be different in the sense that I think the burden would shift to the defendants to be able to come forward and say, he never touched us. We have no evidence that we had anything to do with the conduct. I think the burden would shift, and then there would be liability for the whatever number of people he actually lifted that day. Yes, sir. But here, as in that other case, we have a situation where none of the defendants actually was lifted or approached or touched by the plaintiff.
What test do you think this court should adopt in a case such as this? What are, looking at, we've got some like rules that are generally applicable. What test would you have this court adopt?
It seems to me that in all the theories that are cited by the plaintiffs in his brief and mentioned by the Court of Appeals, we have a common thread running through, and that has to do with active participation or control of the tortious activity. And I think that's where the rule has to come. Whether or not, for instance, we have an unincorporated association here, I think is an interesting question, but I don't think it's really relevant because even in the Galding case, the court noted that membership in an unincorporated association or membership in a common scheme is not sufficient unless there is actual participation in the tortious conduct that brought about the injury. So I think that's where the rule should be. That's where the line should be drawn. If there is active participation, or if there is control or ratification of the tortious conduct that caused the injury, then there can be liability. But in a sense where each of these people is here on his own and not actively participating in the injury-causing conduct, then I think we have no liability.
What would constitute ratification in a situation such as this?
Well, it's hard to say because I don't believe we have a group here or any type of a group that would support the legal fiction if you need a group here in order to somehow impose a group liability on these people. So I don't think we even have an unincorporated association here in the sense of, say, a bar association or some group of individuals that, even though it has no charter, has some kind of meetings to plan out a purpose and so forth. I don't know that you could have ratification of this.
Well, couldn't you have ratification by individuals, such as if they had discussed and agreed to engage in a certain course of conduct?
I think whether or not the persons in this context actually agreed to this course of conduct, I don't think is going to be dispositive of whether these people are controlled or compelled by the group or by the agreement to act in that manner.
Why doesn't that raise a fact question on ratification?
Well, I don't, because these individuals were not actively involved in the decision-making process. It was made very clear, and it's clear from the record here, that each person's actions was left to him or herself. There were alternatives presented to the people as to whether they were to get up and go, whether they were to leave, whether they were to obey the police. And there was no agreement here going in. Therefore, a ratification after the fact, and there would have been no ratification after the fact either. So I don't believe we have an agreement that these people are all going to act a certain way when the police approach, and we certainly don't have any agreement among the people after the fact either. So we don't have any evidence of ratification. And we certainly don't have active participation or control by any of these persons over the lady who actually caused injury to the plaintiff.
If there had been discussion of violence taking place at the demonstration or at the protest, would the answer be different in this case? Would the group members be liable for acts of violence when that had been discussed as an alternative course of action?
I'm sorry. I don't think merely discussing it is going to cross the line here and bestow liability on these individuals. Again, it's simply being a member of a group is not enough in and of itself to cause a liability situation if there's no active participation or control of the activity that goes on.
Can you think of any circumstance where there's a protest and there is violence that other members would be liable for the action of others, the violent action?
Well, I think if there's some either organized it themselves or somehow controlled these individuals, gave them instrumentalities by which they could conduct their violent acts, things of that sort, where there are some indicia of active participation in the violent acts, even if they themselves were not performing the violent acts, then I think you would have that kind of situation.
Mr. Myers, if a person is actively involved in a commission of a tort, you don't need an unincorporated association to attach liability to that individual, do you?
No, sir, you don't.
Okay. The Cox versus the Evergreen that this court decided seems to really discuss or deal with the issue of what's the significance of unincorporated association. And that seems to say that if there is an organization that one of its members commits a tort, the assets of the organization may be liable for the damages, with the concurring opinions talking about the liability of the individuals being limited to essentially their investment in the association, that is, whatever the assets of the association are. What is the significance in this case about whether or not an unincorporated association exists or does not exist with respect to your parties?
again, the distinction between participating in the tort and being a part of an association, one of whose members commits a tort.
I don't think it makes a difference whether or not this group is an unincorporated association. I think my reading of the court's opinion was there's a fact issue about it being an unincorporated association to somehow get to this direct liability theory against the members of the group. The Cox case was a case where the member of the association, it was agreed by everyone that that church was an unincorporated association.
What difference did that make to the outcome of that case?
I don't think it makes a difference with the situation here that we don't have an agreement here that we have an unincorporated association. But I don't think whether it's an unincorporated association makes a difference because of my position, our position that without active participation or control of the tortious conduct, there's no liability. The concurrence and the dissent in the Cox case raised concerns.
What would happen? Well, let me, I'm still exploring this. What would happen if this court, what would the result of this case be under the facts of this case, based on what you assert is alleged by Mr. Arrington, would the result of this case be if this court found this group to be an unincorporated association? What would the result be?
I think the result would and should be exactly the same, because neither the Cox case nor any of the other cases cited by the respondent herein holds the proposition that simply being a member of an unincorporated association means that the individual is liable for the tortious acts of another member. The Cox case specifically held that the negligence of the unincorporated association could not be imputed to the plaintiff. She was simply a member of the association. She was injured at the church. The concurrence and the dissent in the Cox case pointed out the concerns that it could be used, it would have unintended consequences to somehow create a liability situation for members of the unincorporated association. And still in that situation, the concurrence and the dissent stated that we still need a situation where the members would only be liable if they actually participated in the tortious conduct.
How do you distinguish this case from the drag racing cases, the line of cases that holds when two people participate in a drag race and one of them loses control of the car and injures someone, the other participant's liable? How do you distinguish that?
I think in a couple of ways, Justice. So in the drag racing situation, here in this situation, we have the petitioners who were present on someone else's premises, which was a different conduct, we would submit, from the actual tortious conduct that resulted in the plaintiff injuring himself. In the drag race situation, you have the members of the participants in the drag race, and if it's an illegal drag race, for instance, within the city limits or something, each of them is already breaching a duty to everyone else who is there on the streets. In this situation, the petitioners in this case were not breaching a duty to the plaintiff in this case.
Well, they were trespassing.
They were trespassing.
And that was illegal.
If they were trespassing, yes, they may have been breaching a duty to the property owner in that situation, but they were not breaching a duty to Mr. Arrington. If they are...
Well, he's charged with keeping the peace and enforcing the law.
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't it foreseeable that they were breaching a duty after him when they made the decision to trespass?
If they are guilty of trespass, then their liability, if you will, or their punishment for breaching the duty to the property owner or to the general public would be to put them in jail, to have them pay a fine or whatever. The duty that was breached to the police officer was breached by the individual who went limp when he approached her.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
No, we still have...
Oh, we still have petitioner's time. Is that right? They used the time?
Their time is over.
Should we give 2 minutes additional?
I have 5 minutes.
We'll give 2 minutes additional to each side. We'll hear briefly about the fire marshal.
Thank you, my name is Monty Kimball, and I represent Ms. Barbara Baldwin in this lawsuit. She was one of the other protesters. I raised the issue of the fireman's rule. It's never been adopted in the state of Texas. It has been used in a premises case. The standard has been used in Peters versus Detsco and in a premises case. I'm urging this court to extend it beyond the premises setting as other courts have. Illustrative of this concept is the Wynn versus Frazier case. It's a Supreme Court case out of Idaho. And the reason this is illustrative is because it uses the reasoning that has been used by the various courts of Supreme Courts throughout other jurisdictions to adopt the fireman's rule. There's been a lot of reasoning to do this, but basically it's based on public policy and it's basically a duty question. In other words, does this defendant owe a duty to this police officer to protect him? The fireman's rule, simply put, is that an emergency personnel, a fireman or a policeman, cannot recover in liability and negligence in part from a injury caused by the very risk that caused his presence. The policy reasons behind it are because police and emergency personnel have a special relationship in society. The relationship is different than others in that they are required to confront certain risks, and the very nature of the job is inherently has risk. Most of the time the risk will be caused by negligence, somebody's negligence. It's inevitable they will be injured. They are trained, compensated by society to deal with these risks. That's their function. They can be expected. Here the situation was criminal trespass. This court has held that when imposing a duty in tort, when imposing the duty in tort, the court should weigh the risk involved with the likelihood of injury, the utility of the conduct, and the consequences of placing the burden on the actor, as well as the element of foreseeability. When you weigh those factors, I believe that you can see that the fireman's rule is appropriate as most jurisdictions have been.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals refused to adopt the fireman's rule on the basis that protesters were not owners or occupiers of the land.
Exactly, Your Honor. They were basically saying the fireman's rule is a law in premises liability. What I'm urging this court to do is to extend the common law, as many other jurisdictions have, to take it out of the premises context.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May I please report Mr. Gordon Stewart to present argument for respondent.
May I please report? Ladies and gentlemen of the court, I disagree strongly with Mr. Myers on one factual point, and that point is that this is the entire basis of our case, that all of these parties met together, agreed together that they would engage in the disruptive demonstration to block an abortion clinic using techniques of passive resistance to make their removal difficult, that they all knew at least some of them, and perhaps all of them, would do this. And the specific group that were engaged in the blocking were in fact different from the bigger 300 or 400 people group. There was a specific group engaged in the blocking activity that knew they were going to be arrested. That group was carried by common vehicles, met at a common place, carried by common vehicles with a common objective. And they testified in their depositions that they knew that a policeman, if he was going to remove them, was in danger of injuring his back. So the question is, under what theory of law are they not responsible? Because, and I want to cite from a case, I didn't cite my brief because I hadn't found it, and I cite it only because it really addresses the question clearly, and that's the case of Cooper versus Bondoni, B-O-N-D-O-N-I, 841 Pacific 2nd, 608, in the Oklahoma Court of Appeals. And that case cites the general rule, one who commands, directs, advises, encourages, procures, instigates, promotes, controls, aids, or abets a wrongful act by another has been regarded as being as responsible as the one who commits the act so as to impose liability upon the former to the same extent as if he had performed the act himself. You cannot escape liability, contrary to what Mr. Myers said, by saying you don't control the person. If you are engaged together with a person and know that he is going to commit a tortious act, then you are as responsible as the person that commits the act. And the Oklahoma Court of Appeals cited, interestingly enough, for this general rule that it says a national rule, the case of Francis versus Kane, 246 Southwest 2nd, 279, which is the Texas Civil Appeals case out of Amarillo, which held the same thing, and then that case was followed by 1988 by a Court of Appeals case in Dallas, Stein versus Meacham, 748 Southwest 2nd, 516, where on page 518, the court cites the very same quote, almost word for word. And in that case, it was an assault case where the person had a default judgment granted against them, and they came in and said, well, I didn't commit the assault. I didn't touch the person. And the court said that did not even raise a defense because the allegation was that you had planned it. You had planned it, and you see, it was your planning, and you, so the fact that you didn't touch the person does not even raise a defense to that allegation.
How do you square that argument with our decision in Riley against Triplex Communication last term?
Your Honor, frankly, I'm not familiar with that decision.
The case where a radio station and a bar get together and have a promotional gathering, and somebody is hurt as a result of that, and allegation that the radio station for promoting it ought to be as liable as any other one who participated. I think it's cited in some of your briefs.
Well, Your Honor, I think the question is whether the person knows that the course of activity is going to go on. I think the best way I can explain the way I see the distinctions here is the illustration. I think the illustrations are really pretty good from Section 876 to the Restatement Second of Torts. There's two separate illustrations. One is a pair of hunters that are hunting along a public highway, and they both know they're shooting across the public highway. And they both shoot across the public highway. One of them kills the deer they're shooting at. Another one kills a person. But you know, it's not like the drug case or whatever, you know who did which. But the restatement tort says it doesn't make any difference. They're both responsible because they're engaged in a common tortious activity. They both know they're doing something tortious. The restatement second of torts has a second illustration, two hunters that happen.
What section of the restatement?
876, concert of action. The restatement has a second illustration with two hunters simply out there, lawfully hunting. One of them doesn't know. They're hunting together, but one of them doesn't know that the other one is going to do something tortious. In that case, the second one is not responsible. I think the question is, do the people know what is going to happen that's going to be dangerous to police officers? In this case, there's at least a fact issue that they did.
You're saying they knew that an officer was going to be injured when he tried to lift Ms. Salazar?
No, I'm saying they knew that people were going to go limp, creating the foreseeable danger that an officer would be injured.
Is that a tort?
In my view, it is, because one of the reasons I cite that Oklahoma case, it also mentions duty, where it says that you have a duty to abstain from injuring person by careless or intentional conduct or willful acts. And it's clear they didn't intentionally intend to injure Mr. Arrington, Officer Arrington. That's why we didn't allege an intentional tort. However, they did intend to engage in this conduct that they knew would force Officer Arrington to lift them, something that he would not have to do if they weren't engaging in it. And they knew it would create danger to him to do that. And they thought they had a bigger purpose in doing that. And they may be right. I'm not arguing about abortion. I think one of the problems of this case is the protest part of it gets involved with what I regard a very simple rule of tort, and that is people are responsible when they join together to commit tortious activity.
So this is a conspiracy to commit a negligent act?
Well, I think if you read 876 again, the Restatement Second of Torts, they say concert of action easily converts into a conspiracy there's very little difference. You can call it a conspiracy if you want to, but it's really a concert of action. Everybody is acting together. And whether you call it a wrongful, I said in my brief, whether you call it a wrongful conspiracy, whether you call it association liability, whether you can call it concert of action, which I regard as complicity. Concert of action gets, the problem with concert of action is it gets people thinking about these drug cases where everybody manufactures their own drugs and then they're alleged to have acted together. That sort of distorted concert of action into an area where it wasn't originally designed. It was originally designed when people get together to commit a tort, they're all responsible.
Well, what I have in mind is the case that Judge Hecht mentioned, Riley versus Triflex Communications, where we've said that under Texas law there is no such thing as a negligent conspiracy to commit a negligent act. It only applies to intentional.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. I was familiar with that ruling, although I didn't recognize the case name.
How do you distinguish your case from that case?
Well, because even though you can, if you wanted to call it a wrongful conspiracy, you can say there's a wrongful conspiracy, but that's not the basis of the liability. The basis of the liability is the people all agreeing upon and participating in the negligent act. It's not a conspiracy to commit a negligent act in the sense of agreeing, well, all right, we're going to get together and we're going to say, all right, we're going to conspire to go out there and, I don't know, run a red light or something. I think that it is not, the basis of the case is not so much the conspiracy in terms of a group over here that's not involved saying, all right, a group over there is going to do something. The same group. Nobody was sued that was not in this inner group that was out there.
Were all of the petitioners arrested? Is that...
All of them were, as my understanding, arrested. There's only one factual difference among the petitioners. Barbara Baldwin, I believe, is the only one who actually, I think she was arrested. She refused to leave in a lawful order of police officer. I think she was arrested. I'm not positive of that. But she did walk away. She didn't force the police to lift her. That's the only factual distinction among any of the petitioners.
Is that a tort? Is going limp and forcing the policeman to lift you, is that a tort?
Well, I believe that is the key to our case. If that's not a tort, then I don't know whether we have a case in the sense of... The point is they are all out there trying to block the clinic and they are trying to make it as difficult as possible to remove them, and they know, and they're disobeying lawful orders to do so. They're committing wrongful acts and they perceivably know that that's going to cause injury to somebody. That Oklahoma case says that you have a duty not to willfully or carelessly cause injury to somebody. In my view, it is a tort.
Is the lady who walked away that did not go limp, she jointly and severally liable under your theory?
Well, I feel she is, although I feel that's the only factual distinction you could decide differently among the various people. But
because she was part of
the group. She was part of the group that was there, and she knew what the others were going to do. Under the example I gave in the restatement of torts, if both hunters are responsible, but in that case, both hunters did commit the wrongful act, so you could allege, well, there is a distinction there. Whether this court feels a big enough distinction, I don't feel it is. But there is a distinction in that she did not engage in the direct conduct that the others engaged in. I think she clearly knew the others were going to do it. I mean, among other things, she was there, but I think she knew ahead of time. I do think it is also important to realize that we are not claiming if a group gets together and spontaneously demonstrates and they don't know what the others are going to do, even if they're doing something that's the same thing. I think the point is that unless this court is going to say that this general rule of people that act together and commit a tort is not right, and I can't conceive of that because you hold people criminally responsible for this sort of thing, for complicity. If you're not going to hold them complicit in negligence, but you're going to send them to jail for being complicitous, I don't see why that makes any sense as a rule.
Well, you say we hold them criminally responsible for being for participating. What if the people that had attended the meeting and discussed about going flat had not actually shown up at the protest? They would not be criminally responsible for that.
No. Now, whether they were criminally responsible in conspiracy, I think this goes back to the other case. We have not alleged that anybody that was merely there at the meeting, we have not alleged, in other words, a case of wrongful conspiracy. We have not alleged that the 300 people that were at the meeting, that they're all responsible. Whether they are or they aren't.
Now, my point was they were criminally arrested because they themselves were protesting.
Yes, they were.
Not because they encouraged others to protest.
Right. Now, there is a crime of wrong conspiracy, is what I'm saying. So I don't know whether people who conspire to commit a trespass are criminally responsible. I really don't know. I'm not a criminal lawyer. But I don't think it makes much sense to extend civil liability to that extent, except on association liability, and we are alleging it is a private association, although my one disagreement with the Court of Appeals is the fact that they made that the key when I don't think it's necessarily the key. I agree with Mr. Myers on that. But on association liability, it is a private association, in my view, and this case was in fact cited in the recent case from the Court of Appeals opinion in this case was cited in Roe versus Thornburg, which is the Fifth Circuit case 39 F. 3rd. 1273, in this case decided on 1289 and 1290, saying the association doesn't require any kind of formal minutes or formalities, but on association liability, Cox versus the Evergreen Church, I think the Court of Appeals adopted the restrictive view of association liability, which is that people have to participate in it. Now, I think you could argue that if you are part of an association and know some members are going to do something, you perhaps can be responsible. But again, we did not sue any of those people. We only sued the people who actually not only were part of planning it, we sued the people who were part of doing it. Those are the only people we sued, and we did not sue any people just because they planned something.
So if you're trying to organize a protest against the Acme Pollution Company, one of the protesters says, well, I don't know about the rest of you, but if the police come, I'm going to go limp. That if you go out there and protest under those circumstances, you're risking liability.
Well, I think in a sense you're risking liability. Whether that's sufficient to cause liability, I mean, if everybody shouts him down and say, no, we don't want to do that, I think that's why there's a fact issue in this case. Did the people agree enough that this is the kind of conduct that was going to be done? And the only evidence really to justify summary judgment is their conclusory affidavits based on this control theory, and a theory that's not anywhere in the law, that we aren't responsible if we weren't the one being picked up. That's all the affidavits say. They really have established no factual conclusory things of what happened at this meeting. The depositions bury all over the lot of what happened at these meetings. Some people say they were instructed to go limp. Some people say they didn't even hear it at all. Some people say, well, we discussed going limp and we knew we were going to go limp, but it was all our own decision. It goes all over the place. And how can that create a lack of a fact issue, or really more than a lack of fact issue? How can that affirmatively show that the plaintiff has no cause of action? This is a summary judgment proceeding, after all. It's not a case where the facts were developed at trial and we know for sure what the evidence is.
But your view is, regardless of how that washes out, there's still, legally, there's still the possibility of liability.
Well, legally, there's a possibility of liability if there is knowledge on the part of protesters that they are going there and that this is going to be done. Now, the idea that somebody mentioned it and that creates liability, I would reject that idea if that's all that happened. But I think that's what the fact issue is. To what extent did the people that went to this demonstration know what was being done? And I don't see anybody that can read this record, the deposition, to not feel that everybody knew exactly what was going to be done. Certainly there's a fact issue on that. And that's why I say, I think that's why the Court of Appeals went off on saying the first issue is the unincorporated association. The Court of Appeals wanted to reject the idea of what you just said, that somebody could just throw something out and people not realize that was what's going to be done, and then have people responsible. I think the Court of Appeals wanted there to be, in effect, an agreement or association, an idea that this was going to be done.
Mr. Stewart, so that I'm clear, can you articulate one more time for me what duty did the protesters breach as the police officer?
Well, I think it's a general duty. And I hate to I hate to read from the case, but I think it says it better than I can, the Oklahoma Court of Appeals. In terms of duty, these statutes, and it refers to Oklahoma statutes incorporating what I view as the common law, impose on every person a duty to abstain from willful or careless conduct which can cause or contribute to the injury of another. Everybody has a duty not to go out there and injure people. And by forcing a police officer illegally to pick you up because you've gone limp, that is negligence because you are forcing somebody into a hazard they would not otherwise be in. And this is where the fireman's rule would not even be applicable even if it were adopted in Texas outside of premises liability. And I think the Court of Appeals was clearly correct. Texas never adopted outside of premises liability. But the cases on the fireman's rule all say if you act negligently after a police officer is on the scene, it's not applicable. Or if you engage in willful conduct, it's not applicable. Even though this is not an intentional tort, it is willful conduct. They know what they're doing. They know the risk they're imposing on the police officer. And indeed, they're imposing a general risk on the public. I mean, by engaging in disruptive blocking, somebody trying to get into the abortion clinic could trip. I mean, there are any number of ways injuries could occur in this situation. And if it's a legal protest, fine. I don't think they're responsible for guarding against people doing something crazy in a legal protest.
Well, if it was a legal protest that they discussed, if the police show up, we're going to go limp.
Then they're doing something illegal, because the thing they're doing illegally is the police officer, and I disagree with Mr. Myers again, the police officer orders the group to disperse. And they disobey the lawful order of a police officer. Now, if it were an unlawful order, but that's not our situation. I don't know how to get into all of these possibilities or hypotheticals. If it were an unlawful order of a police officer, I haven't thought that through.
But your argument is that the negligent act of a single person can be imputed to members of this group. Is that right?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of imputation. I think it's a matter of if they participate in it. This is not a true rule of vicarious liability. Joint enterprise is a true rule of vicarious liability. You can be responsible whether you have done anything wrong. I am saying the rule in association or complicity or concert of action is you have to participate in the thing that's done wrong. You have to aid it, abet it, know it's going to be done. And that is not a rule of vicarious liability. I mean, whether you say it's fully direct liability or not, it's a matter of semantics, but it is not a true vicarious liability, which doesn't require any fault at all.
We have reaffirmed only recently in several cases, including the Triplex case, that for joint enterprise, you have to have some sort of commercial enterprise.
Right.
Some sort of business purpose. How do you fit your case within what we have just said and reaffirmed in Triplex, that joint enterprise?
Well, because joint enterprise is a rule of vicarious liability, like master and servant. In that situation, you are holding people responsible like a master and servant, even if the servant is instructed, don't do that. If he goes ahead and does it anyway in the furtherance of your business, you are responsible. That's a true rule of vicarious liability. This is not a joint enterprise, like the drag racing or any other kind of thing. If you join together to commit a tort, you are not liable because you're in a joint enterprise. You're liable because you're participating, facilitating, doing the tort.
So you're not proceeding under a joint enterprise theory?
No. We never have been proceeding under a joint enterprise theory, and I reject the idea that joint enterprise has anything to do with this case.
Do you have any authority from any other jurisdiction in the nation where a peace officer or some civil servant recovers against more than one person in a group? For some type of injury caused directly by one of the people.
I'm not saying there isn't any, but I don't have any authority where specifically a peace officer recovers against that kind of group. But I said in my brief, I don't see why police officers should be any different. And this Bondoni case is just like the case, which doesn't discuss group liability, but surely imposes it, just like the case of Dabney versus Home Insurance cited in our brief from this court. Not this group of judges, obviously, but from this justice, but this court, where people who join together and are with the drunk driver and know they're with the drunk driver and don't discouraging but encouraging, that they are responsible for the conduct of the drunk driver. So why should police officers be any different? In other words, As I said in my brief, if you've got a group of criminals, four or five, to rob a store and then go run a red light and run into one of the policemen that is trying to catch them, and they're committing a negligent act that's necessitated really by the conduct they know is going to be happen when they rob the store. They're going to want to get away. They're going to rush through red lights. They're going to do all sorts of things. Why should police officers not be able to recover for that? I mean, what public policy is there that wrongdoers are excused from their negligence because of the police officer? I mean, it's one thing to say people that engage in passive negligence, they just have a rotten floor or something, and a fireman goes out there and it's his job to fight fires and know about rotten floors. We're not going to hold somebody responsible because a fireman's out there doing their job. That is, in my mind, easily distinguishable from saying somebody on the scene sets up some situation that they know is going to be dangerous to firemen, and we're going to hold that firemen can't recover from those people. And I feel that that is not a rule of law.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Of course, in the drag racer situation, or the situation with the hunters shooting across a public street, we have persons who are actively participating in the tortious conduct that causes the injury.
How do you distinguish the, I don't remember the site, it's not from Texas, I don't believe, but the case where the four little boys went to the church to trespass, and two of them could not get in through the front door, but two of them were able to get up in the steeple and ended up dropping a candle and burning down the church, and the court held all four of them liable for engaging in the trespass. How do you distinguish those types of cases?
Well, here we have a situation where the trespass is not the tortious, is not the conduct that caused the injury. We have two separate conduct scenarios here.
But for the trespass, the police officer would not have been on the scene, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, but if I can analogize to the Union Pump versus Albritton case, I think the trespassers being on the scene created the condition under which the plaintiff's injury occurred, but did not actually cause that injury to occur. And therefore, we have a situation where there's not active participation in the conduct that actually caused the injury.
Wouldn't your answer be different if all the people who had gone limp held hands and the police officer picked up one of them and was injured? And I'm not saying holding hands create a much greater amount of weight, but would you say then that that would get us past where we are here, or is that not enough? I mean, I'm trying to understand what you say participate in the injury.
If you're saying if by holding hands the person somehow adds or
is
part of the weight that causes the injury?
Well, as I understand the argument of Mr. Arrington, it's simply that these people encouraged each other to go limp and do this, and you're saying, well, but they didn't have to go limp, but Ms. Salazar chose to, and she's the one, and you want to narrow the scope of this causation to just Ms. Salazar, and I'm saying, would your narrow scope permit liability to the others if they were holding hands at the time?
I think if they're holding hands, they are at that point violating a duty to the policeman who's trying to take them away and lift them away. But in this situation, when Mr. Arrington approached Mr. Salazar, whether or not these nine people out of the 200 were still there or not, had absolutely nothing to do with her decision to go limp and cause the injury to the plaintiff.
Any other questions?
Real quickly, if we adopt, this court adopts Restatement Section 876, do we send this case back for trial?
No, ma'am, I don't believe you do, because you still do not have what is required by 876, which is substantially assisting the conduct or actively participating in the conduct that causes the injury. I don't believe that Restatement 876 really stands for a proposition that's any different from the Galding case or anything or any of the other cases, whereas membership or parallel conduct is not in and of itself enough to create liability. There still has to be a crossing over of participating in the actual tortious conduct that causes the injury.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess before commencing with the second argument.
Please rise.